Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 14th, 2006. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Oregon Republican Greg Walden says he will hold a hearing to examine the pros and cons of academic freedom related to a controversial lugging study. The American Bar Association is yet to either obey the law or change it. And the H5N1 strain of avian flu has shown up in Iran. Portland area weather today, showers to the north, snow above 500 feet, significant snowfall in parts of Troutdale, highs in the 40s. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain or snow, temperatures in the 30s.
Republican Representative Greg Walden said yesterday that he will hold a hearing in Medford next week to examine a controversial study by Oregon State University researchers that suggests salvage logging is harmful to the recovery of burned forest. Walden chairs a House Resource Forestry Subcommittee and said he called the hearing in response to a request from Representative Tom Udall of New Mexico, the panel's ranking Democrat. Walden has co-sponsored a bill to make salvage logging easier after large fires. Now he is saying the February 24th meeting should allow the author of the study to weigh in. The three-year study by OSU grad student Daniel Donato made headlines and a federal agency suspended funding for the study's final year, further inflaming a debate over how to treat the millions of acres of national forests that burn each year. The Bureau of Land Management said last week that Donato had violated provisions of a $300,000 federal fire research grant that prohibits using any of the funds to lobby Congress and requires that a BLM scientist be consulted before the research is published. The agency relented the next day following criticism from Democratic lawmakers that the Bush administration was trying to manipulate science for political ends. Representative Jay Inslee of Washington called on the Interior Department's Inspector General to investigate whether the administration tried to quash research that ran counter to White House policy.
The Washington House passed a new Columbia River Management Plan yesterday, but the measure depends on the fate of a $200 million funding package recommended by Governor Chris Gregoire. The plan focuses on building new reservoirs and conservation. It passed on a 94-4 vote and now heads to the Senate. The plan seeks to make more water available by increasing 2/3 of the water would go to users such as farmers and cities, and 1/3 would go back to the river to help fish stocks. Voluntary regional agreements would rely on new conservation projects to offset new water withdrawals elsewhere. Gregoire said earlier today that the plan could be, in her words, quote, the most significant breakthrough in three decades.
Pre-sex abuse plaintiffs yesterday proposed in the U.S. bankruptcy court that the Archdiocese of Portland pay all their claims without limit. The figure could range theoretically from $53 million to $245 million. The committee that represents the plaintiffs says the actual figure is expected to be much lower than the $245 million and can be funded without having to sell any churches, schools, or cemeteries. Instead, the initial money would come from the Archdiocese bank accounts and $20 million it claims its insurance companies owe it. The Archdiocese issued a statement yesterday afternoon that contended churches and schools might have to be sold, despite what the plaintiffs say. The claimants committee plan provides for those possible sale of all parish churches and schools to pay claims without considering what effect that would have on the parishioner's right to practice a religion as guaranteed by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution and Religious Freedoms Restoration Act. The claimants, on the other hand, say the Archdiocese has enough assets to set up a $66 million claims fund and still be left with $100 million in cash and $400 million in real estate, including $50 million not being used for a church or for a school.
Authorities closed Oregon 39 southeast of Klamath Falls and set up a safety perimeter. Klamath County Sheriff Tim Evinger said workers discovered a 50-pound box of decaying dynamite while digging on private land yesterday afternoon. Evinger's office received a call about 3:20 p.m. that a well-digging crew working at Kingsway off Highway 39 had knocked the lid off a container of explosives just a foot or two below the surface. Evinger said the dynamite appeared unstable. An Oregon State Police bomb squad was en route to the scene from Medford, the sheriff said. The Klamath County School District also was routing buses around the area.
The Parker School District and its teachers union announced that they have reached a tentative agreement in contract negotiations. The specific terms were not disclosed. The agreement resulted from a day-long meeting last week between the district and the Park Roads Faculty Association. After a second mediation session on January 23rd produced little progress, the two sides agreed to meet without hired representatives. Negotiations for the three-year contract had started last spring, and the parties had agreed to mediation after the process stalled in the new contract period this fall. After the January 23rd mediation, the district had offered pay increases of 2% a year. The district had boosted increases to pay for the most experienced teachers and offered increased benefits, this from the Oregonian.
Portland lawyer Tom Nelson told a group of about 50 people this weekend in Salem that the Hamas election in Palestinian territories was remarkably clean, fair, and unbiased. Nelson, a Palestinian solidarity activist, was in the Middle East as an impartial observer during the January 26th election. His talk at the First United Methodist Church in Salem was sponsored by the Salem Area Palestinian Solidarity Group, or SALPAL. Nelson said, "The Israelis did not interfere with the election. We had a boring time. There were no problems. We ended up playing word games." Nelson was among 870 international election monitors. Nelson said that although Hamas's surprise victory likely will mean the loss of U.S. support, it also could help the Palestinians build their country from within. He said that Hamas, which grew out of a terrorist organization, is committed to improving services and reducing corruption. This according to the Salem Statesman Journal.
President of the National Indian Education Association, Ryan Wilson, delivered the annual State of Indian Education address yesterday. As FSRN's Yan Mi-Ji reports from Washington, Wilson says declining funding and intrusive mandates imposed by the No Child Left Behind Act are impeding the advancement of Indian education.
A report by the National Indian Education Association points out that recent federal policies have started to reflect the actual needs of Indian education, and Native American students have benefited from these changes. However, Indian children still have the highest high school dropout rates and the lowest college graduation rates of all ethnic minority groups in the United States. President Bush has proposed to cut funding for several Indian education programs in his budget plan for fiscal year 2007. Wilson says such a setback did not surprise him, as federal funding for Indian education has shrunk systematically in the last 5 years. He says the Congress has told him repeatedly that education of Native American children has to give way to other priorities.
Every meeting you go into with every staff, every congressman, every senator, they're expressing that the natural disaster, the tax breaks, and the war has shrunk the budget. It's a reality. It's not a perception. It's shrunk the budget. And they still consider Indian education a discretionary program, not an entitlement program.
The National Indian Education Association reports that the No Child Left Behind Act is not applicable in Native education settings. According to testimony taken from hearings conducted in Indian country, the report also states the act promotes testing scores at the expense of programs focused on Native language and culture. Under the No Child Left Behind Act, schools that fail to meet state testing standards should be subject to government intervention. Wilson called the act the most intrusive federal legislation in recent history, as it erodes Native American sovereignty.
The tribes who have a unique and special relationship with America, our relationship is federal, not the state. And so they're dictating to us curriculum alignment to meet their standards in our own schools. And so for self-determination and for our values, it's not working.
Joe Garcia is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. He says Indian country, not the federal government, should provide solutions to Indian issues.
Let's not give it to the education people and say you find us the solution. We have to drive the solution, and the solution has to be on our mindset, on our hearts, and our way of life, and I think that's got to be the answer.
The Senate Indian Affairs Committee will have a hearing tomorrow on the state of Indian education. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice appears before Congress today. concerned about U.S. policy toward Iraq, Iran, and the Hamas organization running the Palestinian government, are expected to dominate the questioning. Rice's appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was postponed because of the press of business on the Senate floor. She has been scheduled to appear on behalf of President Bush's proposal to give the State Department $33 billion for the budget year. But that issue is expected to take a back seat whenever Rice does appear because a wide array of international issues has moved to the forefront since Rice last appeared before Congress in October. Last month, the Islamic group Hamas, deemed a terrorist group by the Bush administration, won a decisive majority in Palestinian legislation elections. Many lawmakers have indicated they would oppose U.S. aid to a Hamas-led Palestinian government unless the group renounces violence. Rice will also face questions about the current war in Iraq and America's plans for Iran.
According to Reuters, the American Bar Association
House and the BBC.
Three former associates of Jack Abramoff said yesterday that the lobbyist frequently told them during his lobbying work he had strong ties to the White House through presidential confidant Karl Rove. The White House said yesterday that Rove remembers meeting Abramoff at a 1990s political meeting and considering the lobbyist a casual acquaintance. New questions have arisen about Abramoff's ties to the White House since a photo emerged over the weekend showing Abramoff with Bush. Also surfacing were the contents of an email from Abramoff to a Washingtonian magazine claiming he had met briefly with the president nearly a dozen times. Three former business associates of Abramoff, who worked with the lobbyist in various roles between 2001 and 2004, said he routinely mentioned Rove when talking about his influence inside the White House. One said he was present when Abramoff took a call from Rove's office to confirm a White House meeting that had been approved between Malaysia's Prime Minister and Bush in May of 2002. Abramoff was being paid by Malaysia for helping it in Washington, according to evidence the Senate had made public. All three associates would describe the Abramoff comments only on condition of anonymity. At least one said he had been interviewed by the FBI.
About 12,000 families made homeless by last year's hurricanes began checking out of their federally funded hotel rooms around the country yesterday after a federal judge let FEMA stop paying directly for their stays. The Federal Emergency Management Agency promised the evacuees from Hurricanes Katrina and Rita that they will still receive federal rent assistance that they can put toward hotel stays or other housing, but the agency will no longer pay for their hotel rooms directly. Earlier in the day, attorneys for the evacuees pleaded with U.S. District Judge Stanwood Duvall for a last-minute reprieve, saying the rent assistance will not be enough for decent living accommodations or continued hotel stays. But Duvall denied the request. FEMA said the majority of those checking out have made arrangements for other housing, but some said they have nowhere to go except their own cars, a relative's couch, or back to a shelter. Several said they were heading back to Houston and Atlanta, their original evacuation destinations, giving up jobs in New Orleans in search of a place to sleep.
A Michigan man was shot and injured when his hunting partner mistook his elbow for a squirrel. Michigan State Police said 64-year-old George Seganga of Muskegon, Michigan, was wounded Sunday morning. Seganga was wearing camouflage clothing except for an orange hat which he had covered with the hood after sitting down behind a tree. His clothed elbow was all of him that was visible when his friend, Gregory Scott Wood, approached from behind a tree and fired his weapon. Police are investigating the shooting. The White House had no comment.
Last night, the British government fended off a backbench rebellion designed to derail the plan requiring millions of British citizens to hold an identity card. Their biometric details will then be placed on a central database. Anyone applying for passports or immigration documents will in two years' time be required to apply for an ID card. This from The Guardian. MPs voted by 310 votes to 279 to reject the Lords demand that ID cards could not be brought in covertly by making them conditional on application for a passport. 20 Labour's backbenchers rebelled, about the same number as the first time MPs voted on the issue in October. Civil liberties groups were disappointed and accused the government of bludgeoning their backbenchers. Ministers privately admitted the WHIP's operation is breaking down, with some backbench rebels no longer giving prior notice to their intention to defy the WHIP, a breach of the previous custom inside the Parliamentary Labour Party. The Shadow Home Secretary, David Davis, complained that this represented creeping covert compulsion and the country was sleepwalking towards a surveillance state, and claimed that the ID card database would become a target for every fraudster, terrorist, confidence trickster, and computer hacker on the planet.
Hundreds of thousands of flag-waving Lebanese packed a square in central Beirut today to mark the anniversary of the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, a momentous event that ended Syria's long domination of its smaller neighbor. Thousands of troops and policemen backed by armored vehicles sealed off Beirut's downtown to bolster security. The government gave schools a day off and businesses closed to allow people to participate. Buses brought in people from the countryside. The demonstration in Martyrs Square next to Hariri's grave drew mostly Sunni Muslims from the former leader's sect and Christian and Druze allies. The main pro-Syrian Shiite Muslim groups Hezbollah and Amal were not taking part. The participants included women in both headscarves and jeans, and some carried signs calling for the truth and shouted the name of Hariri's son and political heir, Saad Hariri.
The deadly strain of bird flu has killed 135 wild swans on the Iranian part of the Caspian Sea coast. These are the first such cases detected in the Islamic Republic, the government said today. Indonesia, meanwhile, reported its latest bird flu death Tuesday, a 23-year-old man, while four members of family were being treated in a hospital for symptoms of the virus. Laboratory tests confirmed that the H5N1 strain killed the swans at two locations in the Enzali marshlands during the past 2 weeks. Iran's veterinarian organization said all meat provided under health ministry regulations in Iran were free from bird flu and not dangerous to humans. The strain has killed at least 91 people in Asia and Turkey since 2003, according to the World Health Organization. The virus has been detected in Iran's neighbors, Turkey and Iraq. Almost all the human deaths that have been linked to contact with infected poultry, but experts fear the H5N1 strain of the virus could mutate into a form that spreads easily among people, possibly starting a human flu pandemic.
India's Supreme Court ruled that the French aircraft carrier Clemenceau must be examined by a commission of naval officers to see if it is safe to be dismantled in an Indian shipbreaker's yard. France's defense ministry has admitted to misplacing 30 tons of the asbestos that is supposed to have been removed from the ship. FSRN's Tony Cross reports from Paris.
The French defense ministry claims that 115 tons of asbestos were cleared out of the Clemenceau before it was sent off on its final controversial journey to the Indian state of Gujarat. But now the ministry says that only 85 tons arrived at the center where they were to be buried. Embarrassed officials say that maybe the paperwork was wrong, or maybe the missing material has been misappropriated. Environmental campaigners Greenpeace accused the French Navy of lying when it claims that all but 45 tons of asbestos were removed before the Clemenceau set off. They say that there are between 500 and 1,000 tons on the carrier, and that it's a danger to the lives of the Indian workers who will dismantle it. India's Supreme Court today ordered a committee of retired naval officers to be set up to examine the aircraft carrier to see if it can enter Indian waters. It said that a previous panel of experts, which reported today, was too deeply divided and had failed to answer a number of questions. French President Jacques Chirac is due to visit Delhi next Sunday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Two police chiefs were shot and killed within hours of each other in a violence-plagued region near the United States where drug smugglers had been battling for control of key routes across the border. It wasn't immediately clear if the killings Monday were related, but authorities say violence has spiked in Mexico's northeast since the 2003 arrest of the area's top reputed drug dealer set off the turf war. Hector Ayala, a chief of police in the wealthy town of San Pedro Garza García outside Monterrey, was killed Monday when a car overtook his vehicle and opened fire. 4 hours earlier, Sabina Hidalgo Police Chief Javier García was abducted by armed assailants, bound and shot in the back of the head. His body was found alongside a highway outside the farming town of 30,000, about 50 miles north of Monterrey and 80 miles south of the U.S. border at Laredo, Texas. Garcia had been taken over as Sabina Hidalgo's police chief last month. Nuevo León State Prosecutor Luis Torrevino said investigators have made no arrests and were still trying to determine a motive for the killings.
According to the Telegraph, a major American attack on Iran's nuclear sites would kill up to 10,000 people and lead to war in the Middle East, the Oxford Research Group says in its report, Iran, Consequences of a War. Hundreds of scientists and technicians would be targets in the opening salvos of the attacks, focused on eliminating further nuclear development. The research coincides with the reports that strategists at the Pentagon are drawing up plans for a last resort strike if diplomacy fails. The Oxford report says that Britain could be drawn into the conflict if the Prime Minister allowed the American B-2 bombers to use bases at Fairford Gloss and on the Indian Ocean island of Diego Garcia. More than 100 American bombers, many based on carriers in the Gulf, would take part in a huge simultaneous surprise air attack on 20 key nuclear and military facilities. If the targets included nuclear reactor at Bushehr, a radioactive cloud could spread over the Gulf. Iran's small navy, which includes three submarines, would have to be attacked to negate threats to vital shipping lanes in the Straits of Hormuz. But Iran could still retaliate with suicidal speedboats, possibly leading to crippling rises in the price of oil.
A United Nations inquiry has called for the immediate closure of America's Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and the prosecution of officers and politicians up to the highest level who are accused of torturing detainees. The UN Human Rights Commission report, due to be published this week, concludes that Washington should put the 520 detainees on trial or release them. It calls for the United States to halt all practices amounting to torture, including the force feeding of inmates who go on hunger strike. The report wants the Bush administration to ensure that all allegations of torture are investigated by U.S. criminal courts and that all perpetrators up to the highest level of military and political command are brought to justice. It does not specify who it means by political command, but logically this would include President George W. Bush. The demands are contained in the final report of the Commission's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. The report will be presented at its Geneva headquarters in the next few days. The report is bound to intensify the already strained relationships between the U.S. and the U.N. over the Iraq War. This from the Telegraph.
The United States and Israel are discussing ways to destabilize the Palestinian government so that the newly elected Hamas officials will fail and elections will be called again, according to Israeli officials and Western diplomats. This according to the New York Times. The intention is to starve the Palestinian Authority of money and international connections to the point where, some months from now, its president, Mahmoud Abbas, is compelled to call a new election. The hope is that Palestinians will be so unhappy with life under Hamas that they will return office to a formed and chastened Fatah movement. The officials also argue that a close look at the election's results shows that Hamas won a smaller mandate than previously understood. The officials and diplomats who said this approach was being discussed at the highest levels of the State Department and the Israeli government spoke on condition of anonymity because they are not authorized to speak publicly on the issue. They say Hamas will be given a choice, recognize Israel's right to exist and forswear violence and accept previous Palestinian-Israeli agreements as called for by the United Nations and the West, or face isolation and collapse.
Supporters of Haitian presidential candidate René Préval erected smoldering roadblocks across the capital and occupied a luxury hotel Monday. At least one protester was killed, but UN peacekeepers denied witness accounts that they had shot him. As Port-au-Prince descended into chaos, Préval returned to the capital for the first time since the election Tuesday. He was the clear winner with about 90% of the votes counted, but supporters claimed electoral officials were tampering with results to prevent him from getting the majority he needs to avoid a runoff. The election will replace an interim government installed after former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted in a bloody rebellion 2 years ago. A popularly elected government with clear mandate from the voters is seen as crucial to avoiding a political and economic meltdown in the Western Hemisphere's poorest nation. Gangs have gone on kidnapping sprees, and factories have closed for lack of security.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 14, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO News volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. Liam Delta is on the boards. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
And thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. And be sure to join us for the KBOO evening news at 5 p.m. Coming up later this morning on KBOO, at 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. Their guest is former Willamette Week publisher Ron Buell. He'll discuss his opposition to the current transit mall plan for downtown Portland. TriMet has also been invited. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews Greg Ruka, author of Private Wars, a spy novel set in Uzbekistan. At 9:30, a group of local film buffs will help you decide which films to see of the more than 75 offerings in the Portland International Film Festival. And at 10:30 on Stage and Studio, D-May Roberts has a Valentine's Day special. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And you want to know what goes on in the KBOO Morning News? If you have the guts to help make the sausage, volunteer in the AM newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, showers to the north, snow above 500 feet, significant snowfall in parts of Troutdale, highs in the 40s. Thanks for listening.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
Portland International Film Festival is on again, and as usual, there are way too many films to choose from. But don't worry, KBOO is here to help. On Tuesday morning, we'll present a program of reviews of films in the festival. That's 9:30 Tuesday morning for the Portland International Film Festival.
I'm Carlos Chavez, host of a new radio program called Chicanismo that examines the unique cultural movement and struggle of the Mexican-American or Chicano.